he's a senator now, and they are looking to make friends.
After the campaigns end, the money keeps flowing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 22nd. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, a group of doctors in Anchorage set out to provide better health care that costs less.
I think this can have dramatic impacts. I think this can be very big. We have the ability to truly reset the thinking of healthcare in Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
The campaign for U.S. Senate is over, but the accounting continues. The latest batch of campaign finance reports show Democrat Mark Begich spent nearly $10 million and Senator-elect Dan Sullivan spent $7.6 million, pushing the total spent on the race to $60 million. APRN's Liz Ruskin has been combing through the latest FEC reports and has this story.
Congressional campaigns often end in debt. Holly Robichaud, a Republican political consultant unconnected to Alaska, says she actually advises her clients to spend more than they've got.
You know, if you win, you can raise lots of money. If you lose, usually people help bail you out if you don't, get into too much debt.
But after the most expensive election in state history, neither of Alaska's U.S. Senate candidates appear to have taken that sort of advice. The campaigns aren't closed yet, but Sullivan reported no debt and $277,000 in cash on hand on November 24, the end of the reporting period. Begich showed more cash than debt by about $7,000 on that date. Without net debt, a candidate can't accept contributions made after the election. But that doesn't mean contributors aren't eager to help. Consider Altria Pack. Altria is the company that owns tobacco giant Philip Morris. Its pack sent the Sullivan campaign $5,000 2 weeks after Election Day. It had previously given $5,000 to Begich. Kathy Kiley is a campaign finance expert at the Sunlight Foundation and came up with a name for that: strategic gift revision.
That's the perfect illustration, I think, that the pragmatism of the big political players, really, it's all about influence. And so he's a senator now, and they are looking to make friends.
Whatever Altria PAC intended, a spokesman for Senator-elect Dan Sullivan says the campaign is sending that money back. Altria, he said, mistakenly believed the campaign had debt to pay off. According to FEC rules on post-election fundraising, a campaign must have more debt than cash on the day it receives a check in order to keep the money. Altria responded to our request for an interview about its contributions in the Alaska race with an email describing the company's commitment to transparency. It appears to be lifted from the company website. But on the same day Altria PAC contributed to Sullivan, they also contributed to a raft of other freshmen who won tough races in Arkansas, Colorado, Iowa, Georgia, and North Carolina. Those other candidates do appear to be able to accept the money to pay off their campaign debt. Kylie says that shows the incumbent advantage in fundraising starts early, even before a senator is sworn in.
So you can see that right away. People who want to be the first in your door with a nice, pleasant green handshake and hope that you'll remember them when the time comes to cast your vote.
In any case, Altria and other would-be Sullivan supporters need not wait any longer to make their campaign contributions. Sullivan this month registered a new campaign committee with the FEC for his next Senate run, just as Begich did a few weeks after his election in 2008. In another rite of freshman passage in the Senate, Sullivan also established a leadership PAC this month, True North PAC. Leadership PACs allow senators to raise money from donors beyond the strict limits of campaign contributions. Lawmakers use them to fund certain expenses and to make campaign contributions to other candidates. Now, since it's the holiday season, Let's take a non-cynical view of money in politics. Despite widespread belief that campaign cash sways a lawmaker's decisions, there's little research to prove it.
It's just really hard to separate out the fact that people tend to give to those who agree with them.
That's David Brockman, a political science PhD candidate at Berkeley. He ran a clever experiment that suggests contributions do result in better access. They emailed nearly 100 congressional offices saying they had a group from that lawmaker's district who wanted to meet with the congressmember or top staffers. Brockman says the meeting requests differed in just one way. Half the offices were told the participants would be local constituents. The other half were told the participants would be local campaign donors.
When the individuals were revealed to be donors, they received access at that level almost 20% of the time. Whereas when the group was only revealed to be constituents, they received that access just over 5% of the time. So we're talking about a nearly fourfold increase.
Even that could have a more innocent explanation, Brockman says. Lawmakers and congressional staff may think donors are more savvy about policy and more worth their time. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A controversial mine near Southeast Alaska's border won approval from Canada's federal government on Friday. That worries critics who say the development could pollute salmon-bearing rivers. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Kerr Sulphurates Mitchell Project's environmental protection plan got the okay from Canada's Ministry of the Environment. The project, known as the KSM, is in northwest British Columbia, northeast of Ketchikan, and east of Wrangell. Brent Murphy, of mine owner Seabridge Gold, says the federal action is an important step.
Well, it means that the project can proceed, that we've received both the provincial and federal Canadian government's approval. So essentially, it's an approval in principle, and now we move forward into the permitting phase.
He says the project has about 100 of the 150 permits it needs. It's also seeking investors to develop the proposed $5.3 billion mine. The KSM is a copper, gold, and silver deposit upstream of two rivers that enter the ocean within about 50 miles of Ketchikan. Fisheries, tribal, and environmental groups in southeast Alaska oppose development. They say the mine would pollute those rivers and harm salmon and those who eat them. Canada's action disturbs Carrie James, who co-chairs Southeast's United Tribal Transboundary Mining Working Group.
I'm just, you know, really disappointed in the decision. It doesn't surprise me, and we're not going to stop. We're going to keep fighting, and we can't stop.
Opponents are asking the Obama administration to pressure Canada to use more stringent permitting standards. They're also pressing British Columbia to give the project a higher level of review. Right now, the KSM is an isolated work camp near exploratory drilling sites. Murphy of Seabridge Gold says construction won't start till it gets more permits and substantial financial backing.
The next big regulatory challenge will be the Mines Act permit for the mine site, and that's the permit that's required that we require in order to start construction on our water storage dam and all the associated water management structures.
The next big step would be a permit for its tailings storage facility. That would include dams to hold back rock left over from processing ore. Those dams are a key area of concern for opponents in Alaska. James of the Tribal Working Group points to August's massive tailings dam break at the Mount Polley mine in central British Columbia.
It's been called one of Canada's worst environmental disasters. And the Mount Polley failure was a wake-up call for us. And, you know, we can't let Alaska waters be polluted by BC mine waste.
Seabridge Gold says its tailings dams will use a different structure than Mount Polley's. Critics say they're still worried about breaks spilling toxic metals and water. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Recycling 101, what you can put in that bin and why it matters.
You reach a point very quickly that the contamination really lowers the value of the material.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by The Fish Basket Coalition, working to secure a bright future for Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea, where fishing means business. Visit fishbasket.org to learn more. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Just a week after a vote shooting down a controversial proposal to ban commercialization in commercialized marijuana within Anchorage, the City Assembly is forming a new committee to handle local implementation in the months ahead. The committee is called Regulation and Taxing the Cultivation, Manufacture, and Commercial Sale of Marijuana, and will be headed by District 3 Assemblymember Ernie Hall of West Anchorage.
We'll be making direct inquiry of all of the community councils for their feedback to us, but I intend to hold a number of meetings where we will be taking public testimony.
The idea is to collect input from local stakeholders, advocates, and members of the public, and bring those perspectives to negotiations in Juneau as the state develops its own policies and procedures. Hall also says the committee will let the municipality decide how to regulate marijuana just as the state is starting to issue commercial licenses a year and a half from now.
What I would like to see done is that we take all of the input that we've got in regards to conditional use so that we end up with what would be a standard conditional use permit.
Hall says it's much too early in the process to have the economics ironed out, but expects that much like alcohol and tobacco, marijuana sales will be taxed by both the state and municipal levels. Bruce Schulte with the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation, an organization that has supported commercialization efforts, says the group looks forward to working with the city as new policies are drafted. The challenge, Schulte says, will be finding the right level of taxation, one that covers administrative costs but isn't so expensive that customers are driven away from the legal market. The committee's first meeting is tomorrow. A group of doctors in Anchorage hopes to do a better job caring for some of the sickest patients in the city. It may cost more money initially, but in the long run, the goal is also to save healthcare dollars. The new group is called Alaska Innovative Medicine, and as APRN's Annie Fite reports, the idea is based on a kidney dialysis clinic in Anchorage.
Cesar Jose spends 12 hours each week sitting in the same brown recliner at Liberty Dialysis in South Anchorage. On a recent morning, he settles in with slippers, a blanket, and breakfast.
Donut and cranberry juice.
After a weight and blood pressure check, a technician hooks Jose up to the dialysis machine. A small tube will serve as his kidney for the next 4 hours.
So you're off and running. You need anything?
No, I'm okay.
Okay, I'll be right back.
Okay.
Jose is 67 years old and has kidney failure, but his labs are perfect.
That's why Dr. Gitomir told me, you're boring because everything every month is the same. So that's what he said the last time I talked to him, that, Cesar, you're boring.
Boring is what Dr. Jeremy Gitomir is hoping for. To get there, Jose has a team of providers, a doctor, a nurse practitioner, a nutritionist, a primary nurse, a technician, and a social worker. They work together to make sure Jose stays as healthy as possible. It sounds simple, but Gitomir, who co-owns the clinic, says it's a long way from the standard in dialysis care when he came to Alaska about a decade ago.
The death rate for dialysis patients was 25%, which is terrible. And the patients really didn't have close supervision. In fact, it was kind of a survival of the fittest.
Gitomir does things differently. Cesar Jose's team understands his basic health stats, like his potassium level. But they also know Jose has a weakness for hamburgers, that he wants to visit his 4 kids and 11 grandkids in the Philippines, and that his wife lost her job recently. To get that kind of information, the whole team sits around a sprawling conference room table with patients and their families 4 times a year. 6 months ago, Gitomir says he had a patient who kept telling him, "I'm fine."
I didn't realize that her husband was dying of Alzheimer's. There was a tremendous strain on her family who was caring for her and her husband. We were able, during that family meeting, to hear all of this information, get him plugged into many Alzheimer's resources, remove the burden from the family, and now she's not just doing fine, she's doing great. She's actually thrived, and it's really been, you know, one of those simple things that we never would have done in the past because we just never would have figured it out.
Gittimer estimates it costs his clinic at least 50% more to care for patients compared to more typical dialysis centers in Alaska. In the long run, though, he's convinced his patients save substantial healthcare dollars. And data from Medicare back him up. His clinic has one of the lowest hospital admission rates in the country. A few years ago, he started wondering if a similar model could work for other chronically ill patients in Anchorage. Gittimer began talking to other doctors about setting up a group that would coordinate care for some of the sickest patients in the city. Dr. Terry Lester was on board from the beginning.
I think this can have dramatic impacts. I think this can be very big. We have the ability to truly reset the thinking of healthcare in Alaska.
The group Lester and Gittimer came up with is called Alaska Innovative Medicine, or AIM. A health insurance company, Primera Alaska, is providing the seed funding. Starting in January, AIM will take Primera's sickest patients and focus on doing a better job transitioning them from the hospital to home and providing more of their care at home. After a decade of working as a hospitalist in Anchorage, Lester has a long list of things he can't wait to do differently.
Physicians as a whole have not been very involved throughout a lot of reform in healthcare, and I think that's one of the biggest problems because we're the one who every day we see where things fall through the crack. We see where the inefficiencies are, where the problems are, how we could do it better.
Lester gives the example of a patient with a complicated case who's discharged from the hospital on a Friday afternoon. Home health services may not be available until Monday, which means the patient is on their own at a time when they're at a high risk for being readmitted to the hospital. AIM will have a case manager and a social worker to make sure the patient has help in those critical hours. They'll also coordinate with the patient's primary care doctor and specialist. Gittimer says one thing the doctors won't do is focus on cost.
Primera has guaranteed any home care that we have recommended for the first 30 days after any hospitalization, no questions asked, which is amazing when you think about that.
Home care is not cheap, but it is a lot less expensive than a hospital. And long term, AIM's goal is to save money, maybe a lot of it. The group wants to reduce hospital readmissions for their patients by 25% by the end of the 3-year demonstration project. They want to reduce ER visits by 6%. Gittimer thinks it's going to work for a simple reason.
We're allowed to basically care for patients like we'd want to care for patients.
If it is successful, AIM wants to use the same model to help the state's Medicaid population. Gittimer says that's where the group can have the most impact on the overall health of Alaskans and on the price tag of one of the biggest drivers of the state budget. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University, a private nonprofit committed to personalized experiential learning that incorporates Alaska as its principal classroom. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
A permanent home has been secured for 2 black bear cubs rescued last month. The animals are being temporarily housed at the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage, but as KUAC's Dan Brosh reports, they'll soon be headed outside.
One of the orphan cubs showed up at a remote homestead near Eagle. The other was rescued in the Kisilov area. Fish and Game transferred the young animals to the Alaska Zoo while searches for approved wildlife care facilities to take them were conducted. It took several weeks, but Alaska Zoo Director Patrick Lampe says both bears are going to the lower 48.
Fish and Game was able to find homes for both of them. They'll be going to the International Exotic Animal Sanctuary in Boyd, Texas. And so they're going to be leaving here probably around the first of the year.
Lampe says the eagle cub, a male which came in first last month, and the Kisilov bear, a female who came in later, are both very small for cubs of the year.
first one that came in was 29 pounds, and then this newer one was only 15. So I don't know if they were runts of the litter or very late births, possibly, but just kind of unusual for them to be this small this time of year.
Lampe says the cubs are housed together at the zoo and getting along well.
Cubs usually spend the first 3 years of their life with their mother and, you know, more times than not with a sibling. So it's great that they have, you know, another bear cub to kind of socialize with.
The two cubs are the 8th and 9th the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has placed at outside care facilities in 2014. That's far more than the normal 2 or 3. And Lampe says it was challenging for the state to find them a home.
Black bears are found in every state except Hawaii. So being able to place them in good zoos or facilities in the United States is tough.
Lampe says the Texas facility where they're going has taken other Alaska bears in past years and will be a good place for the cubs.
We all wish that they could, you know, remain out in the wild. That's where they really belong. But it's good that they can, you know, be ambassadors for their species and have good lives and good homes.
Before the two cubs head south, Alaskans have a chance to see them at the zoo. The Alaska Zoo has opened the cub facility to public viewing. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A rare winter robin has been spotted in Bethel. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
Bethel resident Myron Angstman spotted and videotaped a robin outside his window on Wednesday. He says that's not the only unusual thing he saw. Angstman says his wife looked out through the kitchen window and saw a red squirrel hanging out with the robin.
And the red squirrel bounded into the feeder and chased the robin out, and the robin came and landed in a tree right by the kitchen window. So then we got a good look at it, and I got some pictures.
Angstman says the robin was eating birdseed because the bugs it would normally feed on are nowhere to be found in winter. He adds that in his 40 years of living in Bethel, he's never seen a robin in the middle of December.
It's always really spring before they get here. They don't show up in the end of winter at all. It's usually May sometime, usually late May, I think. I'm not precise on that, but it's usually pretty warm out when you see your first robin.
Angstman attributes the robin sighting to climate change. Christine Soule, a wildlife biologist with the Yukon Delta Wildlife Refuge in Bethel, agrees.
I would not be surprised if the milder weather is making some of these birds that are more northerly wintering birds, you know, tend to just go lower 48 rather than the tropics. Some of them seem to be sticking around. So we're seeing some changes in the birds, and I'm sure it's related to the climate change.
Soule says she's received a flurry of calls and emails from people who saw robin in Bethel over the past few weeks. She even spotted a robin herself on November 22nd. Soule says the wildlife refuge doesn't have any documentation of a robin sighting in mid-December in the YK Delta ever. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Do you recognize that sound? That's KSKA's Ann Hillman dumping or recycling into a bin. There are a lot of rules about what you can and can't put in that bin, and those rules can be confusing. So Ann hopped in a recycling truck to sort it out.
A black 9-foot-long arm extends out from the lumbering red truck, and its claw clamps down on a blue recycle bin. The arm hoists the bin into the air, and recyclables tumble into the truck. Empty, the bin's placed back on the ground, and the truck moves on. Solid Waste Services employee Garrett Fairclough guides the maneuver from inside the cab.
It's pretty much one big video game. And that's how that's what I say. I was saying, can you play video games when I train people? Because if you can play video games, you can pretty much do this job.
Fairclough has been picking up trash and recyclables for about 3 years. He says it's simple, but he can talk continuously about the intimate details, like swaying motions of different trucks, the problems of open cans filling with water and ice, the flurried mess of loose grass clippings. He winds his way down a narrow neighborhood alley.
It's cool. It's fun. I love going past schools because they're all like, "Big man, honk your horn." And I'm like, all right.
In the back of his truck, he's carrying co-mingled recyclables. That's paper, cans, and plastic bottles. But not all plastics. Mary Fisher is the executive director of Alaskans for Litter Prevention and Recycling.
All plastics are not created equal. Let me just say that first. All plastics are different.
Fisher says people in Anchorage can only recycle plastic bottles with necks that are marked number 1 and number 2. The bottles are not the same as plastic containers called clamshells, even if they're marked with the same numbers.
And that's because in the plastic world, number 1 PET is just the name for the resin that's used. And then chemicals are added to that resin to form it in certain ways. And so a different chemical is used to form a bottle than is used to form a clamshell.
Which means they melt at different temperatures. Mixing the two reduces the value of the plastic. Fisher says that's a problem, especially now when the prices for recyclables have been low for about a year.
The recyclers are very nervous because their profit margins are very, very low right now.
So they can't take low-value items like number 5 plastics. Fisher says a couple of inappropriate recyclables mixed into a bale of 1s and 2s may not make a huge difference.
But you reach a point very quickly that the contamination really lowers the value of the material.
So does food contaminate a recycle load? Not really. But Fisher says you should rinse all of your bottles and cans because it's more sanitary for all of the people who handle them in the sorting process. And what about plastic caps? First it was no, now it's yes.
We have changed because the technology that manages this material has changed, so you can recycle your lids with your plastics.
Fisher says many of the changes have happened because it makes people more likely to recycle.
It's the only industry that I know of that depends on people doing the right thing in their household in order to get the basic material to make the new product. What other industry is there in the world that depends on you doing the right thing?
Back on the road, Faircloth's truck is full. He takes the recyclables to the Anchorage recycling facility off of Dowling and dumps them into a massive pile.
So pretty much we use the packer blade to shove it all out.
When the area is full, the recyclables are crushed together into square bales, packed into shipping containers, and sent off to Seattle. There, they'll be sorted and sold and potentially turned into things that you will recycle later. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Stacia Eaton in Bethel, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.